My mother's life was a life of secrets. She would only let you know what she wanted you to know.
She was smart. She was charming. And she was diabolical.
She became whatever you wanted her to be, and she had no limits.
A skillful deceiver with a vicious streak.
They were deprived of food. They were often physically tortured.
A criminal mastermind willing to kill to get what she wants.
There were flex cuffs, 22 caliber rounds, a Glock handgun.
I can't imagine that poor woman's last moments on Earth.
She thought that she could get away with murder.
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own, it's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Contributing editor Susanna Andrews exposes the sins of the mother. Manhattan's Upper East Side, known for its posh hotels and restaurants, upscale shops, and some of the nation's most valuable real estate. Like this mansion, owned by Irene Silverman.
Irene Silverman was 82 years old. She was the widow of one of the wealthiest, most successful men in New York City. And she was a very flamboyant, life-loving, life-affirming widow.
Irene is a petite and pretty ballet dancer in the early 1940s when millionaire broker Sam Silverman first spots her pirouetting on stage at Radio City Music Hall. They would be inseparable for almost 40 years. After Sam dies, his vivacious and fun-loving widow, famous for carrying a bottle of champagne in her purse, loves to entertain at her Upper East Side mansion.
She was in this Beaux-Arts mansion on East 65th Street, a place that all of us would dream about living in. She used her home after the death of her husband as a place for well-to-do visitors that would rent space from her in the mansion.
They were apartments. You had a living room and a sitting room and a bedroom. She would have fabulous parties with people from every walk of life in New York.
Apartments in the mansion could go for as much as $6,000 a month.
A staff of 10 maintains the six-story residence and its seven luxury apartments. And on July 5th, 1998, it is one of the housemaids who first discovers that Irene Silverman is missing.
It was a holiday weekend, so most of the staff was gone. There was one maid there, and the maid went out and did some errands, and she came back and she called for Irene, couldn't find her anywhere. She just vanished into thin air.
This was very, very unusual. She never, ever, ever left the house by herself.
The police are notified and are soon conducting a thorough search of the home.
And there was no sign of any struggle, no sign of anything being out of order. Nothing appeared to be missing.
The police questioned everyone, and nothing is amiss except that there had been a new tenant. And what staff told the police was that Irene Silverman had been very suspicious of this tenant. And they said his name was Manny Guerin.
Manny had come in June looking to rent the apartment. He presented himself as a business person from Florida.
He was a very handsome young man, probably mid-20s, gorgeous smile, lovely business suit. And she was going to tell him that she'd have to vet him and call him back. But then he pulled out a wad of cash, $6,000.
She took the cash. And she only realized within maybe a week or so that something was amiss with Manny Gearing.
Irene Silverman was a very meticulous person. And she had cameras in the house, and according to her, he would consciously turn away from the cameras that he became aware were at that front door. Once she became uncomfortable with Manny Gearing, she then directed her attorneys and managers to begin doing what would be necessary to evict him from the apartment.
When investigators arrive on July 5th, Manny Gearing is nowhere to be found. Police start to gather information about the mysterious tenant.
The police sketch artist talked to the staff and residents. They were able to put together a sketch of Manny Gearing.
2 days later, New York Police Detective Edward Murray, who had been tracking a fugitive for writing a bad check in Utah, comes across the artist's sketch.
I showed up at work at about 4:30 a.m. on July 7th. I go up to the teletype machine, and that composite sketch was dead on. I'd never seen a more accurate picture or composite sketch on an individual. Spot on, Kenny Kimes.
Irene Silverman's mysterious tenant, Manny Gearing, was actually Kenneth Kimes.
23-year-old Kenny Kimes and his 63-year-old mother, Sante, are two of the most wanted criminals in the United States. Police consider the pair criminal masterminds and consummate grifters. Kent Walker knows better than anyone. Sante Kimes is his mother.
My mother's life was a life of secrets. She would only let you know what she wanted you to know.
Sante Kimes was born in July 1934 in Oklahoma City. Her father was from India, and her mother, Mary, was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister. And Sante was the third of their four children.
I know that Mom and her family were on very rough times.
Her father was a farmer of sorts, and her mother did laundry for the neighbors.
Sante is just 6 years old when tragedy strikes.
Her father died and left her mother with four kids without any means to support them.
Mary clearly had a very hard time supporting her family, doing laundry.
Sante's mother moves the family to Los Angeles, where they struggle to get by.
We were living off some type of store and ranch shack apartment. When I try to imagine my mother's early years, not sure where your next meal's coming from, I couldn't imagine what it'd been like for her.
Sante had to find her way as a child and begin to learn how to survive. It was a tough way to grow up, for sure.
At that time, she was wandering the streets. She was an exquisite child with almond skin and sparkling eyes and so intelligent. And her strongest trait was that she could be whatever you wanted her to be. And she wandered into a diner attached to a movie theater. And she was so hungry, the owners of the diner fed her. And she came in and day out.
The couple who own the diner adore Sante and convince she needs a stable home, persuade her mother to give Sante up for adoption. They know a loving couple in Carson City who want to adopt a daughter, Ed and Mary Chambers.
Ed Chambers was a senior officer in the Nevada National Guard. Very respected in the small town. She was 12 years old when she arrived in Carson City. I often thought that's when her identity shifted.
Mom went from being a street kid to being a child of a very normal middle America family.
I've often tried to imagine what it was like to have to fit into this entirely new existence and to do it instantly. And Mary Chambers just doted on her. She had her own bedroom. She was given horseback riding lessons. She had the most beautiful clothes.
Sante eagerly embraces her new life. And by the time she reaches high school, Sante is determined that she will never be destitute again.
I don't think I've ever met anyone in my 55 years that has a personality that was half as strong as my mother's.
Soon after celebrating her 23rd birthday, Sante Kynes marries Ken's father, Ed Walker.
Ed Walker had been her high school boyfriend.
He was like a cross between James Gardner and Rock Hudson. And he was smitten with her from day one. He was ambitious, but he was also very malleable to mom. She wanted a real estate empire. And my dad was going to college to become an architect. He dropped out of school at mom's beck and call and started becoming a developer. And they started building houses, doing spec houses. And he was successful, he was doing well.
But 3 years into the marriage, Ed Walker would start to see a different side to the woman he adored.
In December of 1960, the kitchen of Ed and Sante's home went up in flames.
I believe my mother did set the fire on that first house that my father built. I have no doubt in my mind. But his insurance companies did pay, and he was able to sell the property at a profit.
I think it is the first indication that a mental instability is showing itself. And that would be one of the essential elements of her ability to cheat people and then eventually kill them.
Kent Edward Walker, the son of Sante and Edward Walker. Kent's childhood memories aren't like most people's. What he remembers is being witness to his mother's crimes.
My mom's history is full of criminal activity, and probably one of the most notable is her arsons. I think there's a total of 4 or 5 homes that my father had built that had caught fire. My father thought the first couple of arsons were accidental. But after a while, I think he started to figure out that, yeah, mom was doing this.
Arson nets the family thousands of dollars from insurance settlements. Sante Walker is slowly mastering the art of the con.
When he loved her, he was crazy about her. And he didn't want to believe it, but I think he knew.
I never saw him got angry. In fact, I don't have one memory of my father raising his voice to my mother.
She later said quite brutally that she never thought of him as a lover. He was more like a brother.
I have a memory of my dad coming inside the house and finding mom in the arms of another man on a couch, but he still stuck around. He put up with more than any man would have. I don't think he ever would have had the strength to leave unless she kicked him out, and that's what happened. But it's not a testament to his weakness, it's more of a testament to my mother's strength of how she controlled people. And she wanted bigger and better things.
Once the divorce is final, Sante never looks back. She and Kent settle in Palm Springs, where she launches her next get-rich-quick scheme.
Once the marriage with Ed is over, she has a project now, and that is to marry a millionaire.
When I was 6, 7 years old, I would go through hour-long lectures with my mother tell me how important it was to marry money. He says, you don't want to be poor.
Sante Walker talks her way into several jobs, positioning herself to be around money, big money. And in 1971, while working for a society magazine, Sante meets Kenneth Kimes, 18 years her senior.
Kenny Kimes Sr. was almost like a Howard Hughes type. You know, rugged, Western, wealthy. He was in real estate.
Kenneth Kimes is divorced. He has two children. And he is a millionaire.
Ken Kimes is an example of the American dream. He was born in Oklahoma. And his family moved to California. Start picking melons, working on farms. Once he left the military, he started developing motels. When he met my mom, his net worth was estimated to be about $21, $22 million.
He was her match. They're both very hardscrabble, tough people who imagined their future and made it happen.
Mom and Ken had a lot of shared qualities, but one was that they liked to beat the system. You know, he's a multimillionaire, but he still loved getting stuff for free.
4 years later, Sante Kimes gives birth to a second son.
It was on March 24th, she gave birth to Kenneth Karam Kimes. And this is a very, very important moment, very important in the whole scheme of things, because she now has a hook into Kenneth Kimes for life.
You know, there's a 12-year difference, but we quickly bonded. He was a cute kid. He was fun, hyper. I love playing the role of big brother to him.
Sante and Kenneth Kimes move to Las Vegas and settle into a home on Geronimo Way, facing the greens of the Las Vegas National Golf Club. For young Kenny, it's not a life most children experience.
Kenny's upbringing was unorthodox in many ways.
I do know that Shante always did everything she could to isolate Kenny and gave the message that he was superior.
Mom started on him very, very young that he was the prince, that he was better than everyone else. He didn't go to school, he had tutors, and it was relentless. Kenny never had the opportunity to develop his social skills the way most people do.
He's homeschooled and tutors the company, the family, on frequent trips to California and Mexico City. To the neighbors, the Kimes family is eccentric and worldly. No one suspects the evil that lurks behind closed doors. In the summer of 1985, a neighbor hears a noise.
Sometime in the night, a neighbor heard banging on their door. He opened the door, and it was one of Sante's young Mexican maids screaming hysterically.
The woman tells police an astonishing tale of kidnapping, torture, and slavery by a ruthless and diabolical woman. In the summer of 1985, a maid working for Las Vegas socialite Sante Kimes runs up to a neighbor's home, begging for help.
And that was the beginning of an outpouring of horrible stories.
The maid tells police that Sante and Kenneth Kimes have lured numerous young women to work in their home over a period of at least 5 years.
The allegations were that they literally would travel down to Mexico and recruit young girls with the promise of a home and so on and so forth.
I remember one time when I was a kid, Ken's wearing a suit, mom's all dolled up, and I'm in the backseat of the Cadillac. And we drive deep into Mexico. And mom would go out, she would just recruit these maids. She said, how great your life's gonna be. Not a lot of work, a lot of time off, a lot of money. Ken would pull over and we would get in the trunk. We'd go through the immigration. I remember I felt bad for the maid because Ken didn't pull over for an hour after we passed the border.
Doug Crawford represented Sante Kynes in a civil lawsuit filed by the maids.
The allegations were that they were forced into servitude. They were not paid. They were deprived of food. They were often physically tortured. I have deposition testimony where one of the maids testified that Sante took a hot iron and placed it on her back.
Ken's role with the maids were just like everything else. He couldn't stand up to mom. I remember him saying one time, you shouldn't be treating these women this way, you know? And mom said, shut up, you don't know what you're talking about. Mom was the man of the house. She had the control.
As a good lawyer, you always look at the scene of the crime. So I went to the house on Geronimo Way, and Sante said I could look around in the house at the maids' quarters. So I wanted to go into the maids' quarters to see if it would have been easy for the maids to escape, if they could have just climbed out the window or whatever. There were about five or six rooms down the hallway. And I looked both ways up and down the hallway, and I realized the deadbolts were on the outside of the doors. These were little prison cells. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up. And I looked behind me, and Sante was standing 14 inches behind me. Sante had a striking appearance. Her eyes could go dark black like a shark. And she was looking through me, and she knew at that moment that I knew.
Sante and Kenneth Kynes are charged with 17 counts of involuntary servitude and transporting illegal aliens.
The center of Ken's world was his money. And he based his self-worth on the balance of his checkbook. A situation like that would wipe him out. So Ken's dilemma wasn't just that he might be spend the rest of his life in jail, but that he might be broke, you know?
To avoid jail time, Kenneth Kynes pleads guilty and receives a 3-year suspended sentence. But Sante Kynes is determined to fight the charges.
Of course, Sante denied those allegations vehemently.
In the spring of 1986, a jury finds Sante Kynes guilty. She is sentenced to 5 years in a high security prison.
It was hard to see her go to jail. But part of me was almost relieved. You know, it was a break in the tension.
Well, as people tell it, little Kenny's life without Sante was a very happy time. Ken loved his son.
He gave a contractor $10,000 to finish a pool on time for the birthday. Ken put him to school right away.
And Kenny was allowed to play with his friends. He was allowed to have his friends come over. I think for Kenny, it was probably one of the very few moments of freedom that he had in his life.
After serving just 3 years, Sante Kynes is released from prison.
When mom got out of jail, it went right back to what it was, only worse. Mom was pissed.
You could break your camera.
According to friends, Sante and Kenneth's relationship is never the same. Some say that Kenneth begins to distrust and even fear Sante.
Mom's and Ken's relationship after Mom got out of prison was a classic love-hate relationship. They were angry, and they were violent, and they were scary.
Kenneth dies of an aneurysm in 1994. In his will, he leaves Sante nothing.
When Kenneth Kimes died, she knew that she hadn't a dime. Everything had been left to his children from his first marriage.
And Sante is simply not the kind of person that can live a middle-class life. So she began to get more and more desperate.
Sante Kimes manages to hold on to the home she shared with her husband for 18 years. But on this night, she plans to turn it into cash. It's 11:19 p.m. when the fire department gets the call. The residence on Geronimo Way is ablaze.
The fire department didn't take long to think that it was arson.
The Las Vegas Police Arson Unit investigates the fire and discovers that the deed to the home had been transferred at some point to a Los Angeles native named David Kasdan.
David Kasdan was a friend of the family's for years. And during the maid's case, Ken was afraid that an attorney was going to put a lien on the Geronimo house. So they had David Kasdan put the house into his name. He said they could transfer it right back. And David thought that it happened.
The insurance company refuses payment, pending an arson investigation. But collecting on the fire insurance isn't Sante's only scam. She has another clever strategy to turn the house into cash. And David Kasdan is at the center of it.
After Kenneth's death, Sante's scrambling to find assets. And, you know, her home, she can't even sell that because it's not in her name. It's in David Kasdan's name. So she figures out a very ingenious workaround, which is that she takes out a $280,000 mortgage on the house in David Kasdan's name, and she forges the documents.
The same month that the Geronimo house burns down, Kasdan learns of the con when the bank mistakenly sends payment books for the loan to his real address in Los Angeles.
Kasdan was just really not happy.
Kasdan asked a friend of his to investigate, and Sante got wind of it and left threatening messages on Kasdan's machine, telling him to be careful, otherwise he could get hurt. Kasdan was irritated. He wasn't afraid. And then on March 14th, 1998, a homeless person is rifling through a dumpster near Los Angeles International Airport, and he finds a body, which turns out to be David Kasdan's. He's been shot in the back of the head with a .22. Sante thought she was infallible, that she could get away with murder.
Two weeks after the body of David Kasdan is discovered in a Los Angeles dumpster, Sante Kimes and her son Kenny are driving a green Lincoln Town Car and heading for New York City, leaving a trail of arson, fraud, theft, and homicide. But what proves to be their undoing is one small-time hustle in Utah for that Lincoln Town Car.
I sold in cars over a period of time. Sante called me one morning and said that they were in the market for another Lincoln. Well, we talked on the phone many a time. I sent my driver to deliver the car. They did the transaction. She signed the papers. She handed him the check for the amount of money. And the next morning, the check wouldn't clear the bank.
Jim Blackner tries for several weeks to get the cash to make up for the bad check, and she keeps putting him off.
Shante would call me, I'd call Shante, and then I couldn't get a hold of her. I have a good friend that was a detective on the Cedar City Police Department, and I called him.
And they end up contacting the federal authorities because it seems she's absconded on a bad check and crossed state lines.
And by now, they were using the car to go east.
Acting on a tip, New York police stake out the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan.
All of a sudden, Kenny shows up, meets Sante. They embrace, they hug each other, and that's when we make the arrest.
Sante and Kenny Kimes are charged with fraud.
She was dumbstruck, I think, for a moment. When they arrested her, told her that it was for passing a bad check to a car dealer in Utah, she couldn't believe it. She said, "You sure this is about the car?" And they said, "Yes."
Investigators interrogate the fugitives at 26 Federal Plaza.
There was something amiss about them, and it really bothered me. She didn't let him make a move without her approval. And he was always seeking that approval from her at any given time.
When detectives search the Lincoln, they discover other potential evidence of criminal activity.
The number of items that they noted in their report, well over a couple of hundred items. Some of those items, flex cuffs, disguises like wigs, 22 caliber rounds, live rounds, a Glock handgun.
They found a pink liquid in a bottle that the police identified as a sedative that is about 10 times more powerful than Valium.
But one item found in the car tells investigators that this is about much more than a fraudulent check.
There was a black bag.
Sante said it wasn't her bag.
In the bag she was carrying, they found $10,000 in cash and an ID that belonged to Irene Silverman.
Irene Silverman was a socialite. On Sunday, July 5th of 1998, she was reported missing by the maid that had worked for her at her residence.
Just 8 hours after Irene Silverman is last seen alive, Sante and Kenny Kimes are arrested for passing a bad check.
Sante voluntarily made statements indicating that she knew Irene Silverman and then she was a friend of Irene Silverman. When that bag was opened, there were diaries in the handwriting of Sante Kimes.
And everything in the diary was literally a roadmap to the disappearance of Irene Silverman.
Leaving Los Angeles months earlier, Sante and Kenny travel to Palm Beach, Florida, where they hear stories of Irene Silverman, a New York heiress living in a $7 million mansion. With a new mark in their sights, they head for Manhattan.
She knew that Irene Silverman rented out her rooms, that Irene Silverman was very wealthy, that she was a widow.
Kenny Kimes, who was known to Irene Silverman as Manny Gearin, he tricked her into believing that he was some well-to-do person from Florida.
The diary was book full of statements, some of which had to do with how to deal with property, how to deal with deeds.
And what they were trying to do was, they were trying to steal the deed to that home located on East 65th Street.
Sante called the title insurance company for the necessary forms. The notary they actually brought to the house. And Sante dressed up as Irene and sat in bed and signed the document, forging Irene's signature, transferring the house to Sante.
And then I think they killed Irene Silverman.
In December of 1998, Sante and Kenny Kimes are charged with the murder of Irene Silverman. But proving it will not be easy.
There was no body and no forensic evidence that connected Irene Silverman to Sante and Kenny Kimes.
I feel that the Kimeses were pretty confident they were going to get away with murder.
The trial of Sante and Kenny Kimes begins in February of 2000.
Authorities say the mother and son had Silverman's bank book and passport on them when they were arrested. They believe the Kimeses were attempting to con Silverman out of her home.
The two insist they are innocent.
And their demeanor throughout the whole court process was unbelievable. Kenny would often look at her, almost for mom's approval.
He seemed very attached to his mother. They tried to hold hands. This was a problem. They were always touching each other, and he'd come in, and they'd take off his handcuffs, and he'd set her hair right.
With no body and no forensic evidence, the prosecution has to rely on the items found in the Lincoln Town Car, especially Sante's diaries with her detailed notes on how to transfer the title to Silverman's mansion.
The police, once they began to piece all of this together, theorized that this drug had been used to sedate Irene Silverman.
Detectives, they feel through their investigation that Irene Silverman was more than likely smothered, was wrapped up in a plastic tarping, possibly the shower curtain.
The search for the body was enormous. They checked the swamps, the whole wetlands along I-95 coming into New York and New Jersey, along the New Jersey Turnpike. Nothing, nothing, nothing.
I can't imagine that poor woman's last moments on Earth. And to die that way is disgusting and shows Sante Kimes doesn't give a whit for the rights or the life of anyone on this planet.
After 3 months of testimony, the jury finds Sante and Ken Kimes guilty. They are each sentenced to more than 120 years in prison. Mother and son now face new charges in California for the murder of David Kasdan.
There was not one millisecond that I even had a glimmer of hope that they were innocent, because I knew they were guilty of everything.
Kenny accepts a plea to avoid the death penalty and agrees to testify against his mother.
He sat there in the witness stand, and he detailed that he went to see David Kasdan. David Kasdan let him in. He turns his back, and Kenny lifts a gun and shoots him in the back of the head. And they found a dumpster and tossed him in.
And he conveyed that Sante Kimes was also involved.
And Sante sat there going, "Oh, my darling, Kenny, darling," she cried to him from the defense table. And he looked straight ahead. He couldn't look at her.
In all of my years with the New York City Police Department, I've been through the gamut. But these two individuals, they were diabolical.
Kenny and Sante Kimes each receive another life sentence for Kasdan's murder.
I saw Mom once in Los Angeles. It is the only time in my memory I've ever heard a sincere apology from my mother. She was still proclaiming her innocence and still fighting and fighting and fighting. But she said, "Ken, I'm sorry for what this has done to you." And I didn't know how to handle it. I mean, it was heartbreaking, but it was too late.
On May 19th, 2014, after almost 16 years behind bars, Sante Kimes dies of natural causes at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women.
I was endlessly fascinated that she had shapeshifted so often just to survive. Sante had a hold on people because she understood what you yearned for. She became whatever you wanted her to be. And she had no limits. She could be really, really loving.
Say hi, Dad. Say hi.
And that's especially scary. That's a dangerous person who weaponizes love like that.
When Kenny graduated junior high school, the kids at the end of the ceremony would go into the crowd and hand certificates to their parents. And Kenny handed me one. The certificate said, "Thanks for being someone I could talk to." And meant a lot.
We're up, we're running. We're getting ready to die now.
I just wish I could figure out what I could have done differently to help prevent this. And I've been searching for that answer forever, and I don't think I'm ever going to find it.